Good morning. My name is Leslie Keller, and I will be your conference operator for today. Participation in this conference call is strictly limited to invited participants. This call is exclusively for financial analysts and investors. If you are not an invited guest, please disconnect at this time. I would like to welcome you to the conference call on the 2024 General Economic Policy Guidelines. All lines have been placed on mute to prevent any background noise. After the speaker's remarks, there will be a questions and answers session. If you would like to make a question during this time, please press star 8 on your telephone keypad. If you would like to withdraw your question, please press star 8 again. I will now introduce you to the speakers. Rodrigo Mariscal Paredes, head of the Economic Planning Unit at the Ministry of Finance, and Maria del Carmen Bonilla, head of Public Credit and the International Affairs Unit, to proceed with their remarks. Please go ahead.
Good morning to everyone, and thanks for joining us with this conference call. With me, as pleasure, is Maria Carmen Bonilla, head of the Public Debt Management Unit. So we will be making some remarks on the global economy, then some remarks in Mexican economy, and then we proceed to explain one of the, or many of the highlights of the economic package that we are presenting to Congress last Friday. And after that, we will be happy to have your questions. So let me just start by saying that at least from the global perspective, we think that the U.S. narrative recession has been cooling down with the expectation of inflation. We think that from when we presented the pre-criteria guidelines in April, we saw that the U.S. economy was, or we were assuming that the U.S. economy was not going to be in a recession this year and probably not in the next year. So we practically have the same estimate that we have for the growth in 2024, coming from 1.5 to 2%. And this is related to what we have also revised by the analysts and the consensus. The recession probabilities, as I was saying, have been revised down, and an increase in chances in soft landing. Inflation has been cooling down, while the economy has been performing better than expected. Still, many indicators have a positive surprise and upward revisions. The PCE inflation was coming from 5.4 in January to 3.3 in July. The job opening rates have also coming down. So we think that this, with the unemployment rate, it's something positive. Practically, we saw with a very positive thing that the Beveridge curve and the Phillips curve have been revised with a minimal employment and output sacrifices. So it's been a shift rather than some increases in the unemployment or in unemployment. So we think that this is still a positive environment for this year and probably next year. However, there are some indicators that are pricing a recession and the risk outlook still uncertainty. One of it is the yield curve, which is inverted since July 2022. That's 14 months. Usually the recession persists 17 months after the inversion. The Conference Board has the negative outlook since August 2022. That's 12 months, and the recession usually starts after 8. And also we've been seeing U.S. corporate bankruptcy filings since the beginning of the year to July, top to 402 for big corporates. And this is one of the highest since 2020. So the overall outlook, it's still risky, and we will keep an eye on it, but I think that the outlook so far has been positive and according to our projections. The recent spike in commodity prices also reflects some structural inflation, the globalization trends, and the Russia-Ukraine conflict. We have contributed to greater commodity price volatility and entrenched inflation in some sectors. And practically, the oil prices have been coming up, and we think that this is more related to supply issues. Agricultural prices, they are more stable around some high levels, but we think this is still a high level relative to historical levels, and some climate shocks and export restriction policies that could bring volatility for the closing of the year and next year. We also been tracking trade fragmentation. We think that this would potentially would put some pressure on the short-term industrial inputs, wages, services, but we're not so sure so far how this is going to impact the long term. Here in Mexico, we have seen some pressures already in this sector that I just mentioned. The monetary policy overall, we think that it's going to be tight, but we don't think that it's going to be further increased so far. But again, this is provided that there's a lot of uncertainty still in the outlook. We see that the market pricing terminal rate for the Fed would be between 5.25 and 5.50, and no more movements in 2023. But again, this is subject to some uncertainty. Then, given the reductions in inflation vacancies, we don't think that this might be needed, but again, let's see. There are some external parts that I want to discuss related to the expectations of 2023 regarded to the U.S. economy. Practically, we think that the consumption will remain strong. We still see some excess savings, and we think that this might be fully depleted until the second quarter of 2024. We think that employment, especially the Mexican nationals, remains strong. Mexican immigrant workers, the jobs have been growing by 1.3% in the year to date, and this is above the 2015-2019 average. The real wage bill of these Mexicans in the U.S. Until July have grown 6.4%. This is again above historical trend. And in particular, the manufacturing is resurging with construction growing very rapidly. This is not very important in terms of the share of the U.S. economy, but for the Mexican economy, it's quite important, basically because total manufacturing construction in the Midwest has peaked. In real terms, have been growing closely to 112%. That's a potential source for pulling import from Mexico, because practically many of the Midwest states have been very close connected to the Mexican export sector. I would highlight three states that are very important, and the imports that they are doing from Mexico in up to July in year terms, like for example Nebraska, Iowa, and Michigan, have been growing more than 50% or 3%, 33%, sorry. So this is going to be an important pulling of the Mexican economy. And probably you know, but we have been gaining consistently more market share of the U.S. imports, practically with respect to 2018, and Mexico has gone up in terms of the share from 14% to 16%, while China, on the contrary, has been decreasing its market share. And I would highlight especially the manufacturing sector, which Mexico has been gaining a lot of market share. Now, we know that there are some traditional sectors of the economy, like transport equipment and beverage, that they were already high in terms of the market share. They keep gaining market share, but there are also some other non-traditional sectors that we've been seeing both an increasing share, but also an increase in the foreign direct investment coming to Mexico, and that is, for example, furniture and textiles and other sectors. Now, in terms of the domestic demand for the Mexican economy, we think that it's going to be strong labor market. The participation, the labor force participation, is at a highest level. And in unemployment, although it has increased a little bit recently, it's still very low relative to historical level. The high formal job creation, again, is still positive. We think that this is something that is increasing above the historical average. And one measure in particular that we keep track is the labor gap, which is composed of unemployment, available workers, and underemployed. And for those metrics, the only one that is still above pre-pandemic levels is the underemployment, and that's not specifically bad news, because it could be that some workers want to have more hours of work. That could be something related to supply that they want, that they cannot find it. But it also could be some signals that there's something cooling down. In terms of the consumption, we think that there's still a very good outcome. Practically, in August, we have the highest level in consumption confidence since March 2019. The metrics that this survey tracks basically have been showing very good results. And the consumer credit, again, despite the environment of high interest rate, has still growing in real terms. And now for the investment, you probably know this, the business confidence indicators, it's at all-time high at 6.5 points in August, and the right time to invest, again, is above a historical average in all sectors. The non-financial credit to the businesses still growing, again, despite the high interest rate, and we've seen an important amount of investment overall with the metrics that we track in a monthly basis. We think that some of this has to do with the effort that the federal government is doing in terms of the key projects, and we've been pretty much surprised how much the construction has been growing and also the machinery and equipment investment. Now, we keep track of some companies that are reconfiguring their factories. This might look like there's some slowing down of the manufacturing sector, especially the one that is more related to the external part, but this is not really the case. This is something that is more of a supply delay, because many of the factories that have been shut down is not related to lack of inputs. It's more related to the reconfiguration of the factories in order to start exporting electric vehicles. Now, let me just briefly comment on the medium-term economic growth, because I think it's important to say that we've been tracking the indicators that at least point us to say that there might be some optic trends in the potential GDP or the trend GDP. There are several signs that the economy has increased its potential GDP, especially from the supply side. Now, I know that these indicators is not observable, so meaning we think we are right, but we don't know if we are right. And eventually, this is like tracking something in the rear mirror, because not until you see many years of high growth is that when people start revising the potential GDP. But let me just share with you some of the indicators that we think point us to a higher potential growth to the economy. So basically, we have all the infrastructure projects that have increased trade infrastructure, connectivity, investment, and energy products. I don't want to spend too much time on the detail, but if you want me, we can leave it for the Q&A session. But basically, we have railroads, the distance, the million of squares in storage capacity, some of the trains, some of the corridor in the Isthmus, that it's quite on track to be used by new factories and that would benefit the economy. We also have some of the refineries and the energy plants of the energy generation infrastructure in the northern part of Mexico. Related to the nearshoring, we also have been seeing a very good results in terms of investment. Some of the regions are more prone to get more investment, especially the free zone of the northern border. Some of the imports that we've also been tracking, there have been very good indicators in terms of the consumption of capital goods that we are importing from abroad, and that points to the fact that this might be an increase in the investment and in the overall capital assets of the economy. Practically many of the imports that we are looking in terms of the material and the capital equipment have been giving us very good results. Now, with related to the labor factor, I would say that the labor factor participation is at a historical level and very low unemployment, so meaning that it's probably that the L factor in the production function is doing good and it's performing better. Now, there's one key that I think is going to be important for the future, in particular the rate of young people that have higher education. That will contribute not only for the labor factor, but also to the human capital factor, to the production function. And in particular, we've been tracking the labor force participation of women that practically from 2018 has grown from 44% to 47%. This means that at least there are 3.3 million women, more women looking to find a job or already have found a job and are participating into the economy. And just to highlight, these are educated women. Practically, these women are young and they have more than the average years of education. Now, in terms of the demographic bonus, some exercises that we have done is that, so if we've seen that, if you see forward that the increasing women labor force participation could extend the bonus and may last longer because the total labor force is expected to start declining in 2048, but the increasing female labor force participation could delay this tipping point. So we did an exercise with the latest growth of women labor force participation, and we think that if this keeps growing at the same rate that we've been seeing from 2019, this could extend the tipping point by at least 14 years. Now, there's also some productivity gains that we've seen in the claims figures that the INEGI has published. I don't want to spend too much time, but I would tell you that you should be looking at some of these measures that at least to me point to us that there's an increase in the TFP growth due to the revision, but also before that this again could you could argue that this would be an increase in the potential of GDP. Now let me stop here and start digging into the economic package. For I would make some comments for the 2023 and then proceed to the 2024. Now, probably if you've seen the numbers so far, but we've seen some shocks that have happened to the 2023 outlook that we didn't expect at the time. One of the main ones has to do with the drop in the oil prices, or what we've seen when we start working on the package. Now the oil prices are coming up, but we also seen an important appreciation. And this is something that needs to be highlighted because it's the first time that the price shock and the exchange rate appreciation come together. They normally went in opposite direction, and that would at least temper or smooth a little bit the prices. Now we have seen two shocks combined, meaning we have seen a drop in the oil prices of about 32% with an appreciation of the Mexican pesos of about 12%. So that has created some stress with the oil revenues. We are expecting to have lower than the program of about 190 billion pesos. And most of it, I would say, it's related to the exchange rate appreciation, at least 130 billion of those. Now, there are other explanations of that drop, the oil prices, the natural gas prices, and other ones that I would not discuss right now, but I would if you want. And with that appreciation of the Mexican peso, it also has come less tax revenues related to the VAT invoices that we expected to have a peso, an exchange rate of 20.6 pesos, but now we have to revise it by 17.5. That is 3 pesos. That means that there's close to 150 billion pesos of less tax revenues. Now, however, there are some revenues that could potentially partially offset this shortfall. First, the state-owned companies have been performing relatively good, so we expect at least close to 100 billion pesos above the program. Most of it is related to the Health Institute of Social Security, the IIMS, and this is related to the labor market and the higher wages that we've seen. They've been receiving more than expected revenues. We also have some non-tax revenues that are above the program, and the excise tax also is above the program by close to 10 million. The financial cost, that is taking away some pressure. Fortunately, here Mari Carmen has been doing a terrific job. So instead of having a shortfall of 70 billion pesos that we expected because of the elasticity, we were going to have higher revenues of about 5.3 billion. So this is a positive news because that would help us a little bit to smooth the shock in terms of the expenditure. And by the end, we expect that the overall primary balance, instead of being close to a deficit of 0.2, it's going to be a surplus of 0.1% of GDP. Now, the debt is going to be lower of about 2.2 percentage points, meaning that instead of closing the year with a debt to GDP of 48.7, we're going to be closing at 46.5. Now, this is important to highlight because that reduction in debt opens a fiscal space to ask for more deficit in 2024, and that's what we are going to be doing. So in 2024, practically the public sector revenues would increase. That would reflect the dynamics of the economy activity and tax measures carried out from the beginning of the administration. Practically, we will have total tax revenues growing at 0.8% in real terms, and all revenues growing, decreasing something of about 11%. This is a shift related to the oil prices, and again, we set a price in the program at $58.7 per barrel. This is related to our formula. We think that this might be a positive thing because we might get higher oil prices than what we expect in the package. But those extra revenues would go to Pemex, and fortunately we saw that materialize. We could increasing the amount of money that we transfer to the stabilization funds. Now, if there is a risk scenario and this doesn't materialize, we will always have something of lower oil prices, and we have some, or we are at least thinking about some coverage of the oil prices from the federal government. The tax revenue are going to be, again, growing at 6.1% in real terms. This is basically related to some increase in the excess tax on fuels. Practically, we don't expect to have any subsidy in 2024, and the quota would increase to 6 pesos per liter. So that would give us an extra revenue that it's being reflected in the tax revenue. Now, the spending priorities in 2024, if you have not seen the document, we practically prioritize some physical investment and product investment. We are, as I was mentioning, we will see less revenues in 2023, so we are extending some of the expenditure to 2024 when we have more fiscal room to do that. The expenditure, it's basically on the Maya train, some of the Istmo corridor, and other water infrastructure projects and energy projects. The social expenditure would be high. Practically, social protection would increase in 12% in real terms, health 5.8% in real terms, and education 2.9% in real terms. The main pressures would be contained. Practically, if you see the total pension expenditure, it's something close of 5.8% of GDP in 2024, and would increase something close to 0.4 and 0.5 to 2030. Now, this is the main part of this is explained by the contributory pensions, so meaning those pensions have a backup related to the contributions that the workers do. but at least 1.4% of GDP is the non-contributory part of the pensions. This is related to the adult program, but we think that, or at least in the projection that we've done with the demographics and the revisions in the average money to be transferred, this would be manageable, and we don't think that this is going to be an excessive pressure into the public finances. Just let me just finish about the path of the PSBRs and the debt. So as I was mentioning, since we are going to be closing with less debt to GDP in 2023, 46.5, we have more room to increase the deficit. So we would increase the deficit, the PSBRs, to 5.4% of GDP. This might seem a lot, but just I need you to remind you that this is the space that it's opened by the lower closure of the debt. This is also related to the higher nominal base of the GDP. That again, this opens a space so that we will end with 48.8% of GDP in debt. So this is very close to what was approved in 2023 of 48.7. This is doing a rebase because recently there was a rebase in the GDP accounting. So we will practically go down in 2023 and just go up in 2024, just to be having the debt stabilized at 48.8% of GDP. Now let me stop here and then get your questions. Thank you.